Hello, everyone out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network, the podcast for people that actually like movies from NPR Illinois Community Voices. And I am Craig. I'm here today to talk to you and host you through one of the great films of 2020. And we're going to talk all about The Trial of the Chicago 7. That's right. I've taken my Mickey ears off and I am putting on my Sorkin hat because I love Aaron Sorkin to death. Joining me today, two of our other hosts from the Front Row Network. First, I have Lou Hare from Guilty Pleasures. How are you, Lou?
I am great. It's always nice to talk about non-guilty pleasures. As much as I love them, I every once in a while do need to go watch some good films just so I can appreciate the guilty pleasures all the more. So I'm happy to be here chatting with you about this.
That's right. There's nothing guilty about this pleasure. And I can say that so many times. And then we also have joining us one of the more recent shows. He's always been a guest on our podcast and a part of the Front Row Network, but Steve Sykes has joined as with his own show, The View from the Back Row, a look at all things disability in film. So Steve Sykes is joining us today.
Hey, Craig, thanks for having me on today. Looking forward to talking about this winner of a movie.
Absolutely. And what we're going to do is we're going to start with a non-spoiler review of the film, talk a little bit about that, our thoughts, our initial impressions, and then we would encourage you to watch this film. I will say the death of theater is something that we can probably talk about, especially in the middle of this pandemic. Movie theaters are really struggling right now, and there's few silver linings in that. But I will say that I think we are going to have access to more of these Oscar contenders this year than ever before. And that's because they are going to streaming platforms. So you can actually pause us after the non-spoiler review and watch The Trial of Chicago 7. I would absolutely ask you to go and do that. And then come back to us for the spoiler review. So we are excited to get started here. Lou, talk us about through your non-spoiler review of The Trial of the Chicago 7.
Well, I think short and sweet, it's one of the best movies of the year that I've seen so far. And I don't, that is not damning it with faint praise because we have not gotten a lot of movies yet this year and we're about to be inundated with a ton of them. But I really enjoyed this movie. I think it's one of Sorkin's best. I think it's one of his best scripts at the very least. And I think any quibbles I have about the movie that we'll get into later on, I think are fairly minor. Overall, it's an incredibly engrossing watch, and it's serious without being overly heavy, which I think is good if you are looking for a drama that's maybe not just kind of if you're as emotionally wrenched as I am at this moment in time, it is a serious movie that also doesn't feel like a burden to watch. There's some great performances in it. The Sorkin dialogue is as on point as it's always been. And I also find that he does something, really kind of remarkable in that it is certainly a politically themed movie. His politics are always on his sleeve, but I think he, even in his screenplay, dials back some of his more, preachier instincts, which I think he can be accused of from time to time. He shows a lot more than he tells in this movie. And I think that's a real strength to him. So by and large, I really liked it. I still think maybe he's a way better writer than he is a director, but I'll get into that in a little bit. But by and large, if you are interested in this movie, if you're a Sorkin fan, it's a must see. And if you're not, you kind of know what you're getting into, but I still think it's worth it.
You know, initially, right after you saw it, Lou, the first thing you said was Sorkin knows his way around a courtroom drama. And I can't agree with you more there. Steve, yeah. Your thoughts on first impression, spoiler-free review of The Trial of the Chicago 7.
Well, I think Lou hit it on the head. The most important thing that you can say about this is Aaron Sorkin. And if you are a fan of his particular brand of dialogue and pacing, you're not going to be disappointed with this movie. It is very Aaron Sorkin. It gets a 10 out of 10 on the Aaron Sorkin scale. Great performances, too. And for someone like me that was just vaguely aware of the history behind this, it's very educational as well. And it gets you in touch with the complexity of that time and all of the issues which seem dead on the nose for discussion today, because we're going through a lot of the same cultural upheaval and self-reflection. So, again, I have a few quibbles with it we'll get into, but by and large, it's just totally engrossing and well worth the watch.
If there's one thing I enjoy more than Disney, it is Aaron Sorkin. And so he's had me from Sports Night to The American President, of course, The West Wing, even The Newsroom. I'm one that will stick by him for that. Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, would have loved to see a full-blown series out of that. I know, Steve, you agree with me there. And absolutely. Also his movies as well, Molly's Game, Charlie Wilson's War, and, of course, A Few Good Men. Just really extremely well-written dialogue, even The Social Network, which maybe got some things wrong with where we were going, looking back on it a couple of years removed.
But he can fix still, that in the sequel.
That's right, he can. And, you know, it's just a this movie, you hit the nail on the head, Steve. It's so relevant to our time. Behind the podcast, we are recording this on Election Day. We have no idea what's going to happen later on today. And so it is kind of a anxiety-ridden time and maybe a culturally anxiety and overwhelming time that we haven't seen since 1968. This mm-hmm. was the year that Bobby died, that Martin mm-hmm. died, that there was this all these riots and protests around the Democratic Convention. Of course, we had Nixon and we had Vietnam. There was so much going on in 1968, you almost could have multiple history classes just on that one year and still not get it all. And so this movie does a good job of trying to bring that context, and it couldn't be more relevant than it is in 2020. Of course, when you start to put together what film you're going to work on next, you don't know what's going to be going on in the country at the time when that film finally sees a release. And certainly the protests that were going on around racial issues and racial injustice this past year, it's not something that you would ever want to predict would happen. But this movie is a movie of its time, and it's certainly relevant to today. And so I would strongly suggest that you go out and see this film. You can see it on your Netflix account. Just pause this, watch it, and then come back and join us for the spoiler review. Anybody else have any non-spoilery things they want to say before we go into that? Lou?
I just also want to say, I think one of the things that Sorkin doesn't, maybe, I don't know, I'm not as much of a Sorkin stan as maybe the two of you, but one of the things that I think he does very well in this movie is the pacing of his dialogue. There's a couple areas where I quibble, we'll talk about it, but for as far as a watch goes, this is, I think we should also mention, this is a very entertaining watch. I think I might have said that a little bit. I just wanted to be clear because I know, you know, as we talk about this, you know, we're talking about heavier topics. And I think one of the things that makes Sorkin as good as he is a writer is that he can talk about, he can make interchanges between two characters in a room crackle. He can make that feel important and tense without, you know, there's only a couple major sequences in the film where there's, you know, quote unquote action. But so I think if you know, like I said, this is not a downer of a movie to watch. I think it certainly can be frustrating at times, but it's only about 2 hours. So it's, you know, we're used to like these, you know, 2.5-3 hour epic movies. Like it's 2/3 of Endgame's runtime, which is kind of funny when you think about it in that context. So yeah, I would absolutely. And I think because it's kind of chronologically told, it's also a movie that if you felt like you needed to watch break it up a little bit, I think you could too. I know the first time I watched this movie, I had to break it up about halfway because I had something going on, and I came back to it and it, you know, you're right back into it.
I will tell you, and I admitted this in our thread, and I didn't get attacked for it as much as I thought I would. There is a big controversy going on in film right now that Netflix has added a feature where you can actually speed up the film, and it does it in a clean way, and you don't really tell that it's sped up. But, you know, being a parent watching this basically on my phone on a weekend morning, trying to make sure I see it right away because I wanted to so bad, I did bump it to 1.25 speed.
I was just waiting for the podcast to publicly flog you for it, not in our private chat. I figured, you know.
And, you know, it's just what I do. I listen to all my podcasts at 1.8 speed. I listen to my audiobooks at 2.0 speed. And so this one, I decided to give it a go. And I thought I'll turn it right off if not. But then I ended up just getting engrossed in the film. And
did you have to, like, drink a Red Bull and eat, like, 3 Pixie Sticks to keep up with the dialogue at 1.5?
Because it wasn't 1.5. I think it was 1.25. But
okay, well, still, I mean, like that the first sequence goes by because it's Sorkin. He spits out exposition very quickly, and I'm like, I when you said that, I was like, I had a hard time watching it the first time. I was like, what was that? How did do you feel like you absorbed all of the dialogue, or still were you able to keep up?
I do. And I didn't realize that was a thing until probably like a quarter of the way through the movie. So at the beginning, when you kind of are just dropped into the courtroom, and maybe we should save some of that for the spoiler, but when you're just kind of dropped in to the situation, then I was watching at a quote unquote normal speed. Okay. So I guess because I'm so used to his rapid fire dialogue already, because it's just ingrained in my memory from all the walk and talks on the West Wing. And again, the long monologues and dialogues that exist in the newsroom, that I didn't feel like I missed a beat. But I know that there are people listening to this who think I have sinned against movies by doing that. So I apologize to you in particular. But, you know, this is, again, the way that we are consuming movies is so much different now, especially this year. But I think that that's really the future of where we're going. And
you
so I know Judd Apatow is turning off our podcast right now, and I apologize to you, sir.
You're 100% off of Martin Scorsese's Christmas card list.
I was already. I watched The Irishman.
You two are done.
I watched The Irishman on the toilet last year, so I was already off of. It was a long time.
I was saying, with as long of a movie as that is, I'm kind of now concerned about your medical situation. Is that why you've lost so much weight? Is there a story that we need
to
know?
That's right. Okay. Steve, any final thoughts before we get into the actual spoiler review?
I'm just trying to picture a David Mamet movie as sped up to 1.25. It'd be like a constant flow of profanity. And that would be interesting. Mm-hmm. Just one more thought. I saw a quote from Sorkin about this movie, and people were asking him about the timeliness of the subject matter. And he said, and whether he leaned into that or not in the writing and the other aspects of production. And he said, we didn't change the script to match the times. The times changed to match the script, or words to that effect. And that totally resonates. And it's a very important movie. And I'll leave it at that for now.
And now here it is. We're going to go into that spoiler section. So really encourage you to pause and watch however you're going to watch it. Watch on Netflix, The Trial of Chicago 7, and join us back here in 1, 2, and 3. So this film, truly, it hits all the right notes for me. And I think, you mentioned, Lou, that we're going to have some quibbles here and there. And I do agree with you. I think that there's been a lot of reporting, something like this comes out that's inspired on true events. And you start hearing like, oh, well, he missed this. He missed that. This was a 5-month long trial that he's trying to boil down into a 2-hour film. And he's got to do, what he needs to do is bring in those flashbacks, because as we mentioned at the beginning, this just drops you right in. So if you don't know about this situation, the first 10 to 15 minutes of the film are probably a little bit jarring, because you are just introduced to the courtroom. You're introduced to the trial, and then some of those flashback scenes, you mentioned the more action-y scenes, Lou, those are really done in flashback. But this for sure is held up by one of the best ensemble casts I've seen in a long time. I would say probably since Spotlight. And so I do want to jump into the ensemble, and I'll let you kind of guide whichever direction you want to go, because I think that it's hard to find. We were discussing this in our thread. It's, there probably is one person they could put up as the lead of this film if they wanted to, which they don't. We'll get into that later. But where do you want to go first, Lou? I'll throw it out to you. Who would you like to talk about first?
Well, I think maybe we should start with maybe the most surprising, I think, of all the performances. And I think that's Sacha Baron Cohen, because all of these other actors, you know, Eddie Redmayne's an Oscar winner. Mark Rylance is an Oscar winner. Joseph Gordon-Levitt's been doing, great work for years in kind of big prestige type movies. Sacha Baron Cohen is an actor who is still mostly known for his comedic work and has dipped a toe in here and there to, you know, moderate varying degrees of success. And he, I think, is, to me, the most electric performance in the film for my money. I've seen the movie twice now, and I do think that he has, you know, people will look at the accent that what he's doing there, and you know, whether or not it's too much or just right, I don't know. But there's a naturalism to him in this character that makes a lot of sense, but it's also naturally funny. He handles the dialogue perfectly. I think it's I wouldn't say he's a lead performer. I don't, and I would agree with you, Craig. I don't think anybody's a lead performer in this. But for all of the great performances, his is still the standout for me. And Abbie Hoffman, who's such a big, you know, bold character in real life, deserved an actor who had that ability, who was kind of bigger and broader, that could play that. And I think he does, but he finds the humanity of Abbie Hoffman too, which I think was, I don't know if anybody could have married those two facets the way he does.
Yeah, Sacha Baron Cohen fans might be yelling at me now, but of course I know him as Ali G and Borat and Bruno. And you've always heard of him mentioned in these more serious turn roles. I know that he was initially up for Freddie Mercury in Bohemian Rhapsody. Of course, that didn't come to pass. But, you know, this was the first time that, for me, he really melted into a role where, even for a while, I was like, oh yeah, that is Sacha Baron Cohen, isn't it? Because to me, he played Abbie Hoffman. He's the perfect actor to grasp that idea of this radical who is really painted in this film as the most free-loving radical of the group. And he does it in a way where he can win you over to that side. He can win you over with his performance to Abbie Hoffman making a joke out of all of this.
It makes you know, sorry.
Yeah.
It makes you understand why people are able to let their guard down in when he's being Borat or Bruno or Ali G, honestly, because he not only is he 100% like committed to a character where, you know, he's really embodying, you know, it's you can't in those moments to compare what he's doing in those movies. You can't break for a second in those spots. He has to stay 100% committed to that character and make it natural to make it seem like this is a real person. But in order to get people to kind of let their guard down, which that's a whole separate discussion for our Borat 2 podcast about whether or not that's a good thing, he's able to get people to let their guard down because of his charm and his charisma. And I think that that's something he brings to the role that I think it's an effortless marriage of actor and character.
Steve, what do you got for me on Abbie Hoffman?
I will say that I am probably in this group the least a fan of Sacha Baron Cohen. I have never really cared for his shtick. I'm not a big fan of the ambush interview genre type thing. That said, he completely knocked me out of my chair in this performance. He just commanded the screen. You didn't realize it was him right off the bat. And just a perfect blend of that sardonic screw everybody type attitude, but also the moments when he realizes just what is at stake here and how significant the moment is. It's an amazing balance and it's an amazing performance. Aside from the fact that every once in a while he kept reminding me of Kramer from Seinfeld for no apparent reason. But yeah, I was, as somebody that's been pretty much anti Sacha Baron Cohen, and I'm sorry to all the listeners that I just offended, but I was just gobsmacked at his performance. He did truly disappear into this role.
Yeah, generally we have about, you know, maybe 2 to 4 or 5 actors to talk about in a given performance. This time we have about 10 that maybe we ought to touch on. So I am going to move us along a little bit. And I think the next logical place to go is maybe not the other quote unquote pseudo lead. We'll get to Eddie Redmayne here in a minute, but I think we ought to talk about Jeremy Strong as Jerry Rubin, because he really is the buddy. He is the person that's going along with Abbie Hoffman and with Sacha Baron Cohen. So he also brings in a really great performance as well, because he's got that little bit of spark to him that where Abbie Hoffman really presents in this movie as someone that is very anti-violence, anti-war, Jerry Rubin almost at times has this conflict in himself. And I don't know, again, I haven't studied enough of the events to make sure that it's an accurate portrayal of how Sorkin has presented this this concept. But your thoughts on Jeremy Strong, and I'll actually start with Steve this time.
I think he did, again, did a wonderful job. I found it interesting that it was a very complimentary performance to Sacha Baron Cohen in that it was not flashy at all. You could see the inner workings of a revolutionary, but it wasn't a firebrand crazy performance. It was just very intense. And it was interesting to see a revolutionary mindset, but also the pragmatism of, you know, this whole system is just rigged against us. And it was a really layered performance, I guess, is where I'm going with this overall, and just fantastic work. I hadn't been particularly familiar with this actor's work before. But that was fine, because it was all about the character, and he nailed it.
Absolutely. Lou, any thoughts on Jeremy Strong as Jerry Rubin?
Yeah, it does make me regret. I still haven't gotten around to starting Succession yet, but I will as soon as I can, because I think I remember him from The Big Short, this performance, I think he was really good, and I did find myself watching him more the second time I watched the film, because as you pointed out, Steve, there's that relationship between him and Cohen, and Cohen does kind of get to be the the flashier role, because he's the more brash character, and I think Strong matches it with a sensitivity that Rubin has, and I don't know, I know of these people, but I don't know how much of that is true to real life or whatever, but there's a sensitivity to him. The moment where, you know, he realizes, where he's talking to Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character about the female undercover officer that kind of seduces
Daphne O'Connor,
him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And was he's genuinely hurt by that. And you see that, like, this is something, it's personal for all these characters, but I also think that some of these other characters that we hear from, like Hayden and Hoffman, are way more dialed into the politics of the situation. And Rubin's character seems to be somebody who's maybe kind of more the touchy-feely character. He might be the more stereotypical hippie that we would all conjure up in our brains. But I think he needed that. And so I felt for that character, and I probably felt more aside from Bobby Seale, I probably felt more for him than I did for any of the other characters in the movie.
Yeah, he was an emotional crux for sure. And, you know, I think we do have to mention Caitlin Fitzgerald, who played Daphne O'Connor, because on IMDb, you actually have to press the see full cast before you actually get to a female in this movie. And so it is a very male dominated movie.
Yeah.
And that's just simply based on the times that it was. I don't know, but she plays a great foil to Jerry Rubin and does a good job going back and forth. You can see she's kind of cold and collected in the courtroom, whereas in the bar scene and on the hill, she is right there with Ruben, and you can see a convincing performance from that. So I wanted to make sure we threw her out just in case she doesn't get talked about as much later on in this podcast. But moving right along, I do think Bobby Seale is a great place to go to, a great transition point. Yahya Abdul-Mateen does such a fantastic job. And talk about one of the most gut-wrenching scenes in this entire film is when he's bound and gagged. It is difficult to watch. I couldn't imagine being in the courtroom that day, even in the 60s, and maybe even especially in the 60s with the Civil Rights Movement and the Voting Rights Act having just been passed. You've got Martin Luther King died that year, and Malcolm X, and you've got the Black Panther Party, and here's the leader of the party being literally chained and gagged in a courtroom, being treated so inhumanely by this judge that it's a difficult watch for sure. And of course, the story here is that the trial of the Chicago 7 truly was more or less the trial of the Chicago 8 when it started. And essentially, Bobby Seale was thrown into this group. They decided they wanted to try all these people together for a conspiracy to essentially incite violence at the Democratic Convention. Most of these people, if you look through history and even do basic research, they did not organize this together. They hardly were in a meeting space together before they met in this trial. But Bobby Seale was one of those. They wanted to get the Black Panthers involved because they knew that the Black Panthers were scary, right? Mm-hmm. Especially to the white jurors. And so they wanted to make sure that they had that aspect going for them too, so they can convict all of these people. And so Bobby Seale, his attorney talks about it in the film, was not available because of a recent surgery. And so he did finally get released. He had a mistrial from this, but really it was a mistrial. It's one of those things that Sorkin got a bit wrong in the dialogue, or he paints this picture as though it was a mistrial and it was in the sight of justice because he wasn't allowed to speak. Truly, it was a mistrial through contempt of court. And so he was thrown back in jail. And he was facing at least 4 years of prison. And so I did a little bit deeper research into the Bobby Seale aspect of things. And even though it provides this sort of glimmer of hope in the movie that he has this mistrial, it seems like it's justice. It truly wasn't. He did not have any semblance of humanity or justice thrown at him by anyone in that courtroom. And so, I think that Yahya Abdul-Mateen does such a wonderful job portraying this and having this burden of this character on his shoulders the whole time. Lou, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think what's interesting, at least the way that the film sets it up, and you know, I think way more about the actual historical background than I do, is that, you know, that happens, that scene happens, you know, shortly after that, you know, Fred Hampton was murdered, you know, the leader of the Illinois Black Panthers. And so he was, you know, what was fascinating to watch was it was a moment of brutality and violence that proved the point of what the Black Panthers were fighting for in that moment. And what's kind of stunning to me, and I guess this is, you know, this is a story for another movie, is to see what the ripple effect of that actually might have been. I think, you know, it's like the prosecution steps in and they say, well, you can't, we need him out of here because you've now made him a sympathetic person. But we never, that never moves. We never move past that. And I guess what I'm, you know, hoping for then, you know, it's the genesis of another, of a whole nother story that I think should be told. And as you pointed out, there's more to Bobby Seale's story than just what happened, what we get from him. And due to the fact that, you know, he's not the crux of the film. His story, you know, this is about the trial, and when he's no longer part of the trial, he's no longer part of the movie. So for about the last third of the film, he's not even in it. Once he's removed from the courtroom, he's done. We don't see him again. And so we never really get a resolution to that character. And so I think that's maybe why Sorkin makes that choice. But I'd agree with you that it's a bit of, you know, it's a bit of artistic license to maybe make it feel like a more of a feel good moment than it actually was, which is fine. I think ultimately it'll have the effect on the audience that it needs to, which is, you know, this was awful. This need, you know, and there's certain modern day parallels we can draw to that, that I guess show that we're still not 100% past that.
Well, absolutely. Steve, your thoughts.
The one scene you're talking about, in which he is held in contempt and literally bound and gagged, is such a visceral moment. And I don't know about you guys, but it immediately took me back to George Floyd. And it just is a gut punch to see how long we've been dealing with this brutality and that we're still dealing with it. And that performance is just breathtaking. And that scene just was a total kick in the gut. Also knowing a little bit about the Fred Hampton angle, to see him on the periphery of the story is kind of heartbreaking on its own, because you know eventually what his fate is, if you're familiar. And I know we have a Fred Hampton biopic coming out that we're all very excited to see. Mm-hmm. So that'll be an interesting thing to put beside this. But we still have so much of this unrest that was going on, you know, what, 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we're still dealing with in many cases, a broken system and a brutal system. And that's one of the more important takeaways from the movie, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I did more of a deep dive after watching, so I didn't know that he was actually bound and gagged in court. And so they do, and this is maybe to the direction a little bit, Lou, and we'll talk about direction of Aaron Sorkin later, more in general, but I did think it was wise of him to build the emotion the way he did, because I just couldn't imagine that would happen, mm-hmm. you know? And so I imagined them taking him in a back room and beating him up 100%. You assume that that's going to happen, but then to take it to that next, again, just removing all humanity from this man. It was mm-hmm. just, it was just really rough. He does such a great job in this film. And I think we probably do need to continue to move along, because again, there's just so many people to talk about. I'm going to go to Dave Dellinger next, John Carroll Lynch, because he is, again, in this cast of characters, this ensemble of people that they brought together for this trial is almost comical, right? Because he's literally a scoutmaster. And he is being lumped in with these radicals and these students and these younger people. But Dave Dellinger was a pacifist in life. And so he was someone that was a conscientious objector from the beginning of Vietnam and even before that. And so his role in this is also pretty great. I enjoy the emotional complexity of that character, because he is being lumped in this with this crowd. He's obviously the odd man out. And then towards the end, you get that punch, right? And he looks at him, he's like, oh my God, I just punched him. Like, even he, the pacifist in this, is just, it's a maddening courthouse. And it really, again, I don't know if that's accurate, if he actually did punch someone. I do know he was called for contempt of court, much like all of them were. But it certainly paints this picture of like how incredibly volatile the situation was, but also from like a sane person looking back at it, how incredibly ridiculous and like a circus level this trial was. Lou, your thoughts on John Carroll Lynch and Dave Dellinger?
You know, he was, I think he's given a little less to do than a lot of the other characters. He doesn't necessarily have the arc that, you know, certainly the arc that Hayden does or maybe Hoffman does or the big showy moment like Bobby Seale does. But I think what he does is kind of what you said, Craig. There's an earnestness to his character that I think, again, each of these different people bring something, a kind of a different shade to ultimately the same goal, which I think is something we'll talk about in future scenes when we get into scenes. But, you know, he is consistent in his beliefs. And we watch kind of the court process brutally break him down, kind of the same way in a different way than it breaks Bobby Seale down. But, it drives home the point of how dehumanizing this trial was and how dehumanizing the system can be, particularly when we look back on it now, you know, which is another point we'll get to later about, were they right or were they wrong in what they were doing? But he's a fantastic character actor. He's been great for a long time in a lot of different things. I think, again, not a lot of flash to that character, but he imbues it with the humanity that it needs.
I think we, looking at this ensemble and these roles that we have, and Steve, I'll let you talk about Dave Dellinger as well, for sure, but trying to wrap my mind around this conglomeration of people that they just threw together for this trial is pretty incredible. And Dave Dellinger is one of those that just sticks out to me as like, this is absurd. This is a crazy group of people to put together and try to say that they were conspiring beforehand to do all this. But Steve, your thoughts on Dave Dellinger?
This may be me trying to impose our current situation too much on this movie, but Dave Dellinger kind of reminded me, symbolized for me, the well-meaning, sincere people that maybe in our current day haven't been attuned to all the brutal side of injustice that's been going on. And he is awakened to it and kind of gets pulled into a revolution that he himself may not necessarily have gotten to otherwise. And I don't know if any of you guys felt that too, but he's almost a surrogate for the allies in today's revolution, for lack of a better term. And the choice of that actor to play that just made it resonate even further. I'll let you guys speak to whether you think that my analogy is off base or not.
No, I think that's really correct, because the first scene that we see of him, he's downplaying how intense things are going to be. He is the one who, while he has his beliefs, he still kind of trusts the system of authority. He's like, yeah, no, Daly's not going to let that happen. It's not going to be a riot. We're just going to go to protest. And like, you know, he is the one who believes that, you know, kind of it's similar to Hayden, but maybe even more so that, things can be done, protesting can be done orderly, and you can just, you know, very politely state your objections and they shall be heard and we shall all, discuss it. No, sometimes things get messy and he kind of gets that full hand. So I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, again, if we're drawing parallels to that modern day, you know, there are lots of people who, are now getting active in the process and maybe, you know, who are joining, standing alongside people who said, this is kind of always how it's been. And this is what happens, I think you're spot on.
Absolutely. Moving along, you know, the two I want to mention in name, but not necessarily comment on, because they were part of this trial. They were part of the Chicago Seven, but they were not. Ultimately, they were the ones that were acquitted. It's actually Abby Hoffman is the person who says, well, this is why they grouped you two in, because then they can acquit you and it can look like it's fair. But that was John Freund and Lee Weiner. So I want to mention their name. They're not really much in the script. They don't have much dialogue at all because they were kind of the scapegoats, right? For the, the prosecution to say, oh, we were fair in this trial. But I do want to talk about the last two of the Chicago Seven. And then I want to talk a bit about the lawyers and, of course, the judge. So I've got five more characters to get us through. And so I think that Alex Sharp as Rennie Davis makes a whole lot of sense because, again, a good performance in my mind. Nothing necessarily overly spectacular. Any comments on Rennie Davis in this film?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just that he looks so much like McLovin, but I have to remind myself that McLovin would be, you know, or that actor is probably in his 30s or 40s at this point and isn't that youthful anymore. But yeah, he does everybody does a fine job. I don't think, again, similar to the other characters, I don't think other characters get more standout moments than he does.
Yeah, for sure. Steve?
I was actually going to say the exact same thing. I kept checking IMDb to make sure that that wasn't Christopher Mintz-Plasse in it. And it was, in fact, Alex Sharp, a completely different actor. Just another key piece of the puzzle and another solid, if not flashy, performance.
Now, I might have saved this guy towards the end of the Chicago Seven, even though he is thought of in history as truly one of the organizers of the disruptions around the Chicago Democratic Convention. Tom Hayden plays a huge role. But here's the deal. I love this film a lot. I don't love Eddie Redmayne in this film. And so it's difficult for me to look at the rest of the ensemble. I think that part of that, in my mind, is the way that Sorkin decided to portray Abby Hoffman and Tom Hayden as two completely different people coming into this. Because when you really dive deep into it, a lot of the antics going on in the courtroom even were coming from Tom Hayden, more so than Abby Hoffman. And Tom Hayden was still... If I made a parallel to today, he's your college Democrat activist that is going out and just, you know, pissing off the establishment. That's what he did. And so I can't tell if it was the dialogue and the character direction that Sorkin gave or if it was Redmayne's performance, but it did not blow me away, much like the rest of this ensemble did. Do you agree with me there, Steve?
I do agree with you. I think it's partly a function of the writing, that the perspective on his involvement seems to shift constantly in the movie. You know, is he like the idealist? Is he a revolutionary? Does he really know what's going on? It was just a little problematic. I think it's also partly due to the performance by Redmayne, which is just kind of weird. I kept comparing it to a Tom Cruise performance for whatever reason. He had very much the same vocal inflection and a pace, and it was just weird. For someone who was, to my mind, supposed to be basically the point of view that we were seeing events through, at least a lot. It was just something off about it. And I don't know exactly what to attribute it to, but it was a little distracting at times.
Lou, what are your thoughts on Eddie Redmayne?
Yeah, so I think this is where Sorkin takes some creative license to give more conflict to the film. And I actually don't mind it because some of my favorite scenes in the movie are the scenes between the Chicago Seven and their kind of the infighting that happens. Now, if that was real or manufactured for the purposes of the movie, I really enjoyed it. It was because I think this, to go back to what I said at the beginning, this was Sorkin showing something rather than telling. He clearly had something in his mind when he wrote these scenes. And that was, you know, Sorkin, his cards are on the table. His political leanings are very much out there. He's definitely, he's very much a progressive liberal. And this was kind of, I felt like those scenes were him. It was basically like watching liberal Twitter, if you're, you know, where everybody kind of wants generally the same thing, but some are more, you know, some people are more half measured in their approach than others. And so Tom Hayden kind of has to take on the, I'm going to get in trouble. I think Hayden's kind of maybe meant to be like more of the Pete Buttigieg Democrat, where Abby Hoffman is the Bernie bro. And, you know, and it's like, no, we need a revolution. And the other one's like, no, we've got to be pragmatic about how we go about it. And so and at the end of the day, they have that kind of moment where, you know, Abby admits he reads Hayden's stuff and he thinks he's very talented, and they both agree. And like, that's that moment where they cool down and they're like, we're on the same side here. We have different approaches. We have different means of doing this, but at the end of the day, we want the same thing. And I think that's what Sorkin was going for with that character. And I thought, again, that was him using these 1968 characters to make a message about 2020 politics, in my personal, the way that I saw it.
And I think that's a really good point in that, in a movie where the drama and the interactions are so organic otherwise, that playing of Hayden against Hoffman kind of is the only really forced moment to me, as far as storytelling, you know, having a firm grip on the story, and it just didn't seem that organic. So I think that's a good observation.
Yeah, I think that's a really right analogy there, Lou.
Yeah. So, yeah. And again, some creative license, because again, Tom Hayden was a guy who thought Hubert Humphrey wasn't liberal enough. So, he's clearly not like, you know, he's way more, his politics are maybe way more, I don't want to say extreme. That's not the right word. Probably more progressive than the film shows. But I didn't mind that. I will agree with you. I'm still very much on the fence about Eddie Redmayne just as an actor. I think he does this thing where, similar to like Christian Bale, he really embodies his characters with lots of tics and mannerisms. And unlike Christian Bale, I don't know if he harnesses them correctly. His choice for his accent for Tom is odd, and the way, and his line delivery in some moments seems just a tad odd. So he's just, again, it's a flavor that's not sitting well with me, his approach in some of his choices that he makes, So yeah, I would agree with you guys that of all the the leads in this film, he's the one that maybe I won't go so far as to say I think it's a bad performance. I just think it's a less effective one than the people around him.
We have an embarrassment of riches in this film, and so it's easy to pin to one performance. And again, I think part of it is Sorkin's doing, more than Redmayne's doing. I think he wants to build towards this end where, you know, we know that Rennie Davis has been keeping a list of names of the people killed in Vietnam since the beginning of the trial, and then at the end, that's what Hayden delivers. And I think that's your, you know, when this is nominated for Best Picture, that's your Oscar moment. That's the scene that they will play.
I got some thoughts about that then, if that's the case.
I'm thinking that is probably the choice that Netflix might make, but let's go ahead. I've got three more to get through very quickly. And very quickly, it's still Mark Rylance and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I mean, these are two mm-hmm. extremely talented actors playing against each other as the lawyers. And Rylance's character, Kunstler, was really brought into this because he was kind of a rabble-rouser and a troublemaker in the way that he would defend people and bring his kind of bombastic attitude into the courtroom. And so I think Rylance does such a wonderful job at that. And I'll also mention that I loved seeing the complexity that Schultz had, and I don't know enough to know if this was kind of put upon the story here, whether or not Schultz was this person that had this dilemma going on the entire trial as to whether or not this was a just thing to do. I'd have to kind of research more into his character. But again, played the lawyers in this, it is a courtroom drama. And a lot of this is going to be hefted by the way that you can act out a motion of a court and, you know, and how you're going to do an objection and, you know, those cross examinations and things like that. And you get two solidly great actors doing that and really moving the story along very well. And that's maybe why the dialogue doesn't ever feel like it drags, because they do such a good job of picking up that ball and moving it forward. Lou, your thoughts on both Rylance and Gordon-Levitt?
Well, I'd like to tie in then Frank Langella as the judge, as we're talking about these,
because sure. And, I think I was going to definitely go to him next, but sure, we can definitely bring him in.
Right. But I think you brought up a good point that I think I'd expand on in terms of, I don't know whether or not that's another creative liberty that Sorkin takes with Schultz, but it makes sense again for the context of the film, because Langella's judge is so corrupt, and so he's both corrupt, senile, incompetent, and hateful. So he's
everything you want in a judge,
right? You know, so if Schultz's character is your typical hard-nosed prosecutor, I think it would be overbearing. You kind of need him to be to have that inner conflict, which again gives that character a new shade to it. You know, again, it's always the, you know, it's a courtroom cliche of the prosecutor who's not really sure they should be, you know, this, that the person that they're prosecuting is guilty or whatever. But it works for this, but it especially works when you consider how Langella's character, or the Judge Hoffman, is portrayed, because he is clearly the villain of the film. And so that makes sense for me. And then, you have Rylance, who I think, again, is phenomenal in this. I think if he didn't have an Oscar a couple of years ago, he might be really strong competition to win Best Supporting Actor in this. He's great, and he gets the firebrand lawyer moments that we come to expect in a courtroom drama. So to see those three kind of triangulate the picture, the different pictures of the law, I think is pretty was fun to watch, and all three of them brought it.
Absolutely, I do agree with you there. And their exchanges, their sides at the bench or in the judge's office in his chambers, they do such a great job of walking that line of, again, they are the ringleaders of this ridiculous three-ring circus, and they do a good job of presenting that and moving that forward. Steve, your thoughts, and we can just go ahead and talk about all three of them at this point.
Right. Mark Rylance, just a wonderful character. Again, he doesn't have a huge amount of screen time, but he really makes the most of it. And despite having a role that might have been tempting to play as a stereotypical, irascible lawyer type, there was a lot of depth and shifting moods about it, and just a great performance. Here's my problem with Joseph Gordon-Levitt's performance. He seems like, and this may just be me, but it seems like he's getting kind of pigeonholed a lot into these roles of the nice young man that's having the internal conflict, trying to be a good civil servant, and yet thinking that there may be a higher justice in play. It just seems like he's been put into that role multiple times. There's
His friends do call him Robin. So
yeah. Well, I mean, there's no, there's nothing wrong with his performance. I'm going to say that it's solid, but it's just strikes me as something he's falling into, and I hope that he keeps expanding and doing a variety of roles. Frank Langella, holy crap, that's who I'm thinking is my best supporting actor out of this group. And I say that even lauding Sacha Baron Cohen's performance as much as I did. But Frank Langella just cut such an impressive, imposing figure as the judge. And just as a force. And he's not a cartoon villain either. I mean, there is depth to his depravity, I guess you could say. And Langella just owns that role and was one of the stronger performances in a movie that is chock full of them. Just fantastic.
This is probably the – oh, go ahead, Lou.
Well, before we leave Joseph Gordon-Levitt too much, because I know we're going to talk about Frank Langella, I think his – Joseph Gordon-Levitt needs whatever the opposite of Botox is. He needs something to age him because he's almost 40 years old at this point, but he still will perpetually looks like someone in their 20s. So he's a really talented actor who I'd like to see do – you know, as you pointed out, break out from that kind of boyish roles. But it's hard when you perpetually look like a college student. So
that's his personality too. I mean, yeah. The guy is like an optimist, an idealist. He has all sorts of charm and energy. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't help anything.
No, he's too nice. So go like on a 6-month bender, JLG or JGL, and age yourself. You know, smoke 3 packs a day, get some Keith Richards wrinkles, and then we can really, then we can see him cut loose. That's what we're asking.
But, or Colin Farrell and become the Penguin as opposed to being Robin, something like that. Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So go ahead and talk to me a bit about Frank. And then I do want to start to wrap up this, this section.
Sure. I think he's great. He's excellent. I watched it the second time looking more at what he was doing because, a lot of people had your thoughts too, Steve, that he seems to be like the front runner out of this group to win an award, not necessarily just to get nominated, but to win. And I, that took me back for a moment. I think it's because, I was thinking more about Sacha Baron Cohen after my first viewing than I was Frank Langella. But you're absolutely right when he says he is given lines that I think in the hands of another actor could be chewed up and be incredibly hammy. Particularly, Sorkin, Sorkin is a very sentimental writer. And his thoughts are always kind of right at the surface there, which is, I think always works. But in the hands of a hammier actor, that would be a hammier performance. And so the humanity he imbues in that character, I think, makes it a really good feat. And the fact that he's, an actor that's been around for decades and has never really gotten his due, it kind of makes that makes all the sense in the world, too.
So we're starting to talk about the Oscar buzz and things. What I want to do, we're already an hour into this show and we've only discussed the ensemble cast. I do want to mention, for our format generally goes to scenes next. We've talked a lot about scenes. Lou, I know you mentioned a scene you wanted to talk about, but go ahead and let's talk about some favorite scenes if we haven't mentioned them before. And then we'll kind of move along to maybe what we didn't like. And then we're going to end with the Oscar speculation because we do enjoy doing that here. So Lou, go ahead and talk to me about some scenes.
Well, I think the scenes, I think we've already hit on my big ones, which were the scenes of the infighting, which I thought really spoke to the current cultural moment that we're in. Political purity tests are kind of a big deal in 2020. If you're not exactly on, if you're on one side, you've got to not just, you can't have any flaws at all in and you've got to be completely pure in ideology, which I think is a concern, but I think maybe that more lives on Twitter than it does anywhere else. But I think Sorkin does a really good job of addressing it in those scenes. I did like using the scenes involving Abbie Hoffman, you know, his stand-up bits to kind of help explain scenes and narrate things. I thought that was a clever device. And I thought the scene of the actual riot that happened at the end was very well executed in a movie that, and we'll get to my criticism later, that I think maybe was a little visually static. That was where I thought the movie, you know, Sorkin does a really good job there of making you feel kind of the chaos.
He puts you in that bar. He puts you in that bar, like watching outside. You're watching this democratic. It's like the two worlds aspects that we're really living through today, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much relevance to today in that scene in particular, because they're in there watching their TV, thinking that everything's going just hunky dory down the street in Chicago. And outside, there's literally police officers and there are protesters, and it's all coming to a head right there, right in front of them. But so many of them are distracted by watching the TV. I love that, because they're too distracted and too focused in on what they want to see as their worldview and not actually looking right in front of their face to see what's really happening. I thought that was a very excellent way to portray that scene for sure. Steve, your thought on any scenes that we haven't discussed already?
We've talked about my two scenes. The Bobby Seale contempt of court scene is obviously gripping, and the riot depiction of the riot is, it really kind of brings everything together. I think it's interesting, the two most memorable scenes for me are the two least Sorkin-esque scenes, at least in my experience. Not a lot of dialogue, but some just really arresting imagery. And it serves, those two scenes serve as a really nice balance to the crackling dialogue that goes on throughout the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's talk, we've been really blowing up this movie, and I think that we all have a very high opinion of it, mm-hmm. but there are certainly some things, there's aspects of every film that maybe you're not as into as others. And, Lou, I wanted you to go ahead and start this off, not because, you're my antagonist here, but because you always bring a good sense of filmmaking to, these shows as well. So talk to me about your thoughts. What did this film not live up to in your mind?
Well, I think I've got a general comment and then a specific comment. I think generally speaking, I think Sorkin is a much more effective writer than he is a director. I think, as I said a minute ago, but just to drill down on it a little bit, the movie visually, I think you could listen to this movie and almost get the same effect. I think visually it's not as exciting and as interesting as it could be. And I know some people will say, well, that's because it's a courthouse movie or whatever. But it's like, well, there's lots of opportunities for him to make this a little bit more visually interesting. And I don't know if he's quite there yet as a director. I would have loved to see this script directed by, you know, someone like a Ryan Coogler, who's got a really good visual, you know, kinetic energy to his scenes that he cuts, or like a Scorsese, or, you know, somebody who can cut, you know, kind of match the dialogue, the fast pace of the dialogue with some energetic directing. I don't know if Sorkin's that energetic. And there's, you know, there's some interesting choices that he makes, like when Abbie gets asked about, you know, does he have contempt for his country? And then they just kind of fade out. They don't, you know, let him have that moment to answer. And it was like, okay, we know how the trial ends, or maybe he's just assuming a lot of people don't. So maybe he doesn't want to spoil that. But the scene that I want to pick on, because you mentioned it, Craig, as the Oscar scene, is that final scene. I love the choice of Hayden reading the names. I cringed at everything that happened after it. Because for as like natural as everything else did to do the sweeping, overbearing, generic happy score with the standing ovation in the courthouse. And Langella, that's the moment Langella just like goes into full cartoon villainy, like hammering the gavel with all of his might. It felt, that is the moment where it's like, oh, we almost got there. We almost made it the whole movie without like, without too much schmaltz. And he just, he lets the schmaltz get the better of him at the moment, because by the way, that's not actually how that moment happened. That is a complete Sorkin imagine, you know, fabrication. And it's not that to say that it's not a great idea to have him read those things, but man, I if we could have just like heard the names and slowly fade out, maybe, I don't know. That's the scene that really,
I'm not disagreeing with you there at all. I'm just saying that the Oscars are going to eat that with a spoon. And that's why they put that in that movie.
That's where you just go with the montage, I think, of like the higher moments of the film. Because, man, I was just like, oh, it felt dated in kind of the way. I think it actually calls back to the end of A Few Good Men. Where Rob Reiner has the giant sweeping courtroom music as like Caffey's given the salute to his defendant, to Downey. And as like it sweeps and then he stands in the courtroom and there's just this bright light shining in. And it's like, there it makes sense. This moment it didn't. And I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You went to the well too many times.
And I think you make good points about Sorkin's directing. This is only his second movie, right? Molly's Game was the first. And Molly's Game also not necessarily visually appealing at all. A good story, but, you know, and I guess how do you make card playing sexy? But that, you know, that it wasn't necessarily like a visually appealing movie. I think what I like about this is, and what I like about, and I know that all three of us are super into theater and particularly into stage acting and to actually plays. That, you know, we go beyond just musicals. We all really appreciate a good play. Mm-hmm. And this would make a killer play. You know,
like
you
could take
this script and you could put it on a stage. And yep. I think that would be great. Mm-hmm. And I can see why some people would be like, that's not my jam. Or I wish that it was a bit more visually appealing. And I'm not saying that that's what you're saying, Lou. But I'm just saying that from someone that could visualize this in my mind being done by a stage full of actors, I was okay with that. Mm-hmm. But I can understand where you're coming from. I did appreciate the moments of flashback because it did provide a little bit of visual stimulation to the whole thing for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think when we're talking, we'll talk about awards. I think, you know, I think screenplay and picture are, you know, strong contenders. I don't necessarily, if Sorkin gets left out for his direction of the film, aside from how good he is of bringing out the best with the actors, because I think that shouldn't be understated. He clearly knows how to work with actors. I just, you know, that's the maybe the last piece of the puzzle before he becomes the well-rounded the five-tool player.
Yeah. Steve, go ahead and speak your piece with the film. Anything that you wanted to mention?
Well, two things. First of all, Lou talking about the direction and the general discussion about the direction, I found it very interesting when I looked at the background of this film. This has been in production hell for a long time. I guess Spielberg was originally attached to direct this. And at the time, he was just about to meet with Heath Ledger to play Tom Hayden. Hmm. But Ledger passed away the day before that meeting was supposed to take place. And Spielberg also at the time wanted Will Smith as Bobby Seale. So it's interesting to kind of visualize where this movie would have ended up in Spielberg's hands. But the other thing, the major quibble that I had with it, and it's not even a major quibble, and it's something that Lou listed as a strength. And I had a hard time at times with the bouncing around to the stand-up routine, the different ways that the story is being told, simply because it jumps around in time so subtly, you can kind of lose your bearings as to where you are. Mm-hmm. And that was my quibble, my biggest problem with the way that the story was structured. Other than that, you know, the brief things that we've mentioned before, it's still a massively effective movie, but that was just one thing that kind of bothered me.
Certainly. I mean, you bring up a really good point, because the flashbacks are presented much in the very same way that the stand-up routines are. And so one of them's happening while the trial's going on and kind of moving forward the narrative. The other one is happening in reverse, kind of showing us how we got to this point. So I can understand that as a point. Lou, what did you have?
No, I agree. I think, I can understand that. See, that didn't bother me as much as the, and we said this a little in the first, is the jarringness of the opening scene where he's just throwing names on the screen and everybody's talking a mile a minute and they're all heading to the same place to set up the action of what the movie's going to be, which is the trial. Because, not being familiar with all of these people, I knew some of them, but that was a little jarring for me. So I think, a little bit, that's where, Sorkin's kind of breakneck pacing sometimes can get the better of him, because without setting it up, I guess that's where, really good editing and, editing and directing put that all together. So I experienced what you did, Steve, just at a different part in the film.
The other big moment of confusion for me momentarily was when we start with the sentencing portion of the trial, and we go from like intense action to them filing in their prison clothes. And it's like, wait a minute, where are we? When are we? Oh, we're doing sentencing now. That a little bit jarring, but I'll give it a pass.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we love talking Oscars on this podcast, and we certainly will a little bit later next year than we are used to, as the Oscars have moved to April. But this is one of our first true contenders that we're speaking about. It's not the first true contender that's out there. There have been other films that are obviously going to get a lot of looks from the Academy. But this is one of the first ones that we are talking about. And so I don't want to spend too much time on this, because certainly we will discuss this film ad nauseum in these categories later on during our Oscar spotlights. But I think it's worth mentioning some of the enormities of this, because yes, you do have this is a very obvious contender for Best Picture, and Netflix is going to be pushing that. Netflix has also announced that they are not going to be running anybody, they're not going to be campaigning for anybody to receive a nomination in the Best Lead Actor category. They are going to run all of these people in the Best Supporting Actor category, and so I want to talk about that in particular in just a moment, because it's not to me who gets in, but how many of them get in, that I think is a more intriguing question there. You mentioned, Lou, I think that this automatically goes in as a best adapted screenplay. Mm-hmm. I say adapted because I think that they will say, because some of this came from the transcripts and it was inspired by true events, that would be, this would be an adapted as opposed to an original screenplay. It's obviously something more historical. Mm-hmm. But I think it'll get a screenplay nomination. And of course, Aaron Sorkin could be up for best director. I tend to agree with you, Lou. I think if there's one place that this movie doesn't end up getting that Oscar nomination, it's probably in that. But before we jump into the supporting actor conversation, anything that you want to mention about other awards that it might be up for, whether that's screenplay, direction, best picture, whatever you'd like to talk about? And I'll go to Lou first.
Yeah, I think all of those are on the table. Especially with it, up to 10 nominees, it would stun me that, we would get 10 other movies. If we get 10 movies better than this one, we'll have a hell of a year. So I think it's a best picture nominee. It's screenplay. The supporting actor is interesting because I think you only have 5 slots. And I think, sometimes votes get split and yada yada, and we don't know what other kind of movies are coming out. So I think at least 2, I think Cohen and Langella are probably locks for nominations. And I think you could probably talk about, Jeremy Strong as maybe a third there, or, Yahad Abdul-Mateen as maybe a fourth. I think those would be my 4 in maybe in that order. But you know, certainly direction's possibly on the table. From my take on it, I don't know if like cinematography or anything like that's really on or score or anything like that are on the board, unless there's like just this huge wave of love for this film or campaigning where it just gets, you know, 10. It doesn't feel to me like that kind of a sweep, but I certainly think those major categories are on the table for them.
Every now and then you get kind of that weird 1960s period piece where costuming gets in. So that might happen depending on how many big costume piece type films we're going to get this year, especially in the middle of the pandemic. And of course, all these films were filmed prior to that. But I think that maybe we won't get so many of the big, huge costume pieces. So I could see maybe something like that going in as well. But certainly, I would agree with you as far as the other categories are concerned. And there's really nothing here from a cinematography point of view to me that would lend it to that. And score is fine, but it doesn't necessarily speak to the necessity of the score in the film like most of the films that are nominated for score would do. Steve, your thoughts on the Oscar nominations?
I think it's a lock for a Best Picture nomination. I think it's probably a lock for a screenplay nomination. I don't see it being nominated for Best Director. And again, I think you're absolutely right. And the question is how many Best Supporting Actor nominations are going to come out of this? I think, 3 is a very distinct possibility. And I wouldn't be surprised at 4. I think, obviously, I've already said Langella, as far as I'm concerned, is going to win the thing. That's my bold prediction. I don't see a lot of the peripheral awards. I don't want to call them lesser awards, but I don't think it's in play for a lot of that, with the possible exception of editing.
Editing is what you didn't like.
I know, but some people eat that up. I don't know.
Bohemian Rhapsody ended up winning editing last year, right? And that movie was.
Yeah. Occasionally, it's just most editing, not best editing. So, you know,
yeah.
You might actually have a point with all the cuts and back and forth and stuff. They may be like, "Whoa, this is edited really well." So,
yeah. I can't wait to be proven right about that.
Mm-hmm. All right, here's my. I like to listen to. This podcast, Vanity Fair, puts it out called Little Gold Men, and they stipulated, they threw out the idea that this entire supporting actor category could go to one movie. And I don't think that'll happen because of vote splitting, because of everything else. I think that I could make the argument that it should happen because Sacha Baron Cohen, to me, that's your winner. And nothing against Langella, but I think that the Abbie Hoffman, and then you also throw in the politics of it, and the Oscars are so political, and you've got a Borat movie that just came out that exposed Rudy Giuliani. I mean, the Academy voters are probably going to want to award that a little bit as well, but also just a killer performance by Sacha Baron Cohen. In my mind, he's your winner. And then from there, I think that the Oscars love to pat themselves on the back. So even though I didn't like Eddie Redmayne in this film, but the fact that he's a previous winner, I think, gives him a potential leg up for a nomination. I would also say the same thing about Mark Rylance. Even though he is a bit more peripheral in this film, he still does enough in the performance to be considered in that nomination pool. And then, of course, Langella as well makes sense to me to actually receive a nomination. But even from there, like you said, there's so many performances in this film. Yahya Abdul-Mateen, talk about a hell of a performance. And you don't necessarily have to have the entire movie or in entire screen time to be able to get those types of nominations for a very, very stunning performance.
I really hope Abdul-Mateen gets a nod was just such a gut punch of a performance.
Here's what I'm. Right. We are sitting here in November, and we haven't seen nearly the amount of films that we will come Oscar time. But there's so many good performances in this. This is where it's silly that I think that the SAG Awards get it right. I will tell you the one lock that I think this is going to have is best ensemble cast at the SAG Awards.
Oh yeah.
But I think that the Oscars, if you're going to want to add a popular movie Oscar, why don't we do it? Why don't we do the ensemble first? Mm-hmm. Because there are enough of those types of films built around this idea of an ensemble cast, not just one actor carrying the load. You can find those in every single year, whether that's Spotlight, whether it is a film like Black Panther, whether it's Trial of the Chicago 7. You know, you've got these performances that are just bolstered by so many good actors or actresses coming together and lifting a performance and making it just something that's a spectacle to watch and just so enjoyable. So Lou, I went on a diatribe there. I saw you wanted to mention something.
Yeah. Well, I think what I'm will be intrigued by for many, 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 many reasons is how our cultural and political landscape shifts in the next 2 to 3 months. Because I feel this is a movie that will land differently in January, one way or the other. And that will ultimately impact voters. Because as you pointed out, you know, the awards aren't until April. This movie could almost, I mean, who knows? Maybe it feels dated by February. I don't know. Life has happened so fast this year. There's been so much stuff that has happened that, you know, a lot of times Oscars reward movies of the moment. And in this moment, this movie feels of the moment. But what will it feel like in 3 months? Well, you know, yeah, depending on who our president is or who or what our government looks like or where our current political and cultural situation evolves to in those months. So that I think how this is married to that, it's interesting. It's maybe one of the, you know, it's a movie that for better or worse is kind of tied into where we're at politically at this time. And yes, it's that, you know,
and fantastic observation.
The studio, and again, we need to wrap this up so I can continue doom scrolling Twitter for the rest of the day as we record this on election day. But I think it's also interesting because this is a conversation that we can have. This Netflix, Amazon, Hulu to a certain extent, at some point Disney Plus will get in the game. They have been fighting for award contention and for legitimacy through awards for several years now. And because the pandemic struck and because so many of these large studios had to sell their movies off basically just to continue to make money in this pandemic, I think this would be an obvious year for potentially a Netflix to win a Best Picture, whatever the case may be. However, there is still one major studio movie out there, and who knows if it's going to be any good, but it's got Tom Hanks in it, and it's based on a very popular novel called The News of the World. And so I could see, like, even that, you know, that whole idea of this is still one studio picture, and in this time when all of Hollywood shut down and movie theaters are closing, we have to back our big studios and we have to make sure that they are still making it. So I think there's a lot of politics, even within, and of course there's always politics around the Oscars, but even within the Hollywood community, it'll be very interesting. And you make a very good point, not just our political relevance, Lou, but also the political relevance within this discussion of Hollywood and the direction that it's going in. Mm-hmm. We always knew, at least I think we as consumers always knew, that streaming was the way of the future, but this pandemic has brought the future now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the one thing, you know, we talked about this way back in the previous Oscars, you know, back in February, 18 years ago. One of the things that I think hurt many, you know, The Irishman and Marriage Story, which were two, I thought, excellent films that only combined one award. Oscar,
at least one of them was pretty good.
Yeah, part of the uphill battle Netflix has when it comes to winning awards is campaigns. And when a movie is in a theater for 2 to 3 months and people have a chance to see it and word of mouth gets out there, that helps and bolsters your Oscar campaigns. When a movie drops on a streaming service, everybody watches it within the first week or two. And this movie, like I said, you know, they will have to, it will take some serious effort 4 months from now to people be like, hey, remember the Trial of the Chicago 7? Remember that one? Can we talk about it again? And I think that's going to be a fascinating conversation. conversation to see how these streaming services try to like jog our memories of movies that we may have binged and forgotten about.
You know, I think that that's a really good point, and maybe I'll end on this, is that the marketing, depending on which direction they want to go, they also have a huge platform to market this film. I was very surprised, and maybe it happened a little later than this, but I watched this. This dropped on a Friday in October. I watched it on Saturday morning, and it was not the featured Netflix thing on the top of the screen. And so I wonder if they're saving that for later. You know, to be like, here's your Oscar contenders around the, you know, around the time that award season starts to come back up or whatever. Because if they put that up there, that's going to get millions of eyeballs immediately. And so they do have some power in how they push these things and how they market these things. And I do think that a lot of these, because of the pandemic, they're going to be facing themselves in terms of, you know, who their competition is for this upcoming year. So, but I this is a fascinating conversation. We are going to have so many opportunities to talk about the Oscars all the way until April. It feels almost unfair to have an Oscars conversation without Brandon Davis here as well. So we want to make sure we continue that into the future. What I will say, just my final thoughts, and then I'll of course let you have final thoughts as well. I will eat up with a spoon anything that Aaron Sorkin feeds me. And I'm so glad that he continues to write and he continues to bring this. There are people out there that think he's pretentious and that he, you know, he's not as good of a writer as he, but, and I get that. You all of us have our own personal preferences. I just love Aaron Sorkin so much. And I'm glad that he brought this film to us at this time, because to me, it really speaks to the power of the moment and the thinking in American history, 1968 and 2020, I think have a lot of combined threads, commonalities that maybe we don't even see necessarily ourselves right now. But for me, being a forever optimist, to look at the tumult of that year and how it took a while, right? It took a good deal of time, but we did make our way out of that and we moved forward. I can only say that I hope that that's a bit of an allegory for where we are today. And this won't all end immediately, but over time, we will get to a better place. So that's my optimistic view for you for today. But Steve, any final thoughts from you?
First of all, dead on as far as comparing 1968 and today. And I share your wishes for resolution. My big takeaway is how much I love ensemble movies. And between Knives Out last year and this, I really hope that we see a renaissance in terms of blockbuster, if you will, ensemble movies, because it's just such a joy to watch magnificent actors sharing the stage or the screen, as it may be, together. And I really hope that the Oscars eventually take your advice, Craig, and institute a Best Ensemble Award, because I think that would only promote more great ensemble films being made.
Yeah, absolutely. And so much like Julius Caesar handing over the mic to Mark Antony to wrap up, friends, Romans, lend me your ears. Lou Hare, what do you have to tell us for a final thought?
Well, first final thought, courtroom Sorkin is better than political Sorkin. Don't at me. I'll take this. I saved that for the very end before, so we could.
This is now going to be a 2-hour podcast.
So you know, yeah. I saved that for the end so we didn't have to go off on that tangent. We'll save that for the Oscar spotlight. No, I really enjoyed this movie. It does work for better for me for some of the reasons that you pointed out, Craig, about, you know, I think Sorkin's best instincts work it for me better in the courtroom setting than they do in the political world, because he doesn't get the chance to have characters just straight up monologuing his political beliefs. Even if you agree with his political beliefs, it can still be sometimes. And you know, I like all of his work, so I'm a fan, but you know, I got to get that in there. But I would say to, you know, my final thought, what struck me as I walked away from the film in that final moment, even though I didn't like the execution as the final scene, what I think this movie points out is that protesting has a root cause. There's something at the bottom of it, and they keep bringing it up in the film. We shouldn't forget why we're here. These people were there to protest the Vietnam War, a war that was unpopular, but their protesting of the war was even more unpopular at the time. There was violence. They were, you know, vilified. This group of people, were they the most honorable human beings to ever walk the planet? I don't know that. But what we do know is that history proved them right. History proved them right for what they were doing. The movie vindicates them at the end when they, you know, the government eventually gives up. They don't retry the case on appeal. They all kind of achieve that vindication after the fact. No one wins at the end. By the end of the film, they have not won. No one's won. Their vindication happens after the fact. And so what I guess the parallels to this, you know, and I think as we're all kind of making our political voices heard, and whether you're, you know, part of the protesting or whether you agree with them or disagree with them, you know, ultimately we shouldn't lose sight at what is at the root of protesting. The cause that's being asked about. What are these people asking for? And you have a choice to either demonize those people and or point to the violence that's happening around them, or you can choose to look at the root cause of what they're talking about. And I think because ultimately that's what history is going to do. Notice today we're not talking about how violent, you know, those things got. Yeah, did they get out of hand? Maybe. But the cause was there. And I guess if that's the parallel that I walked away from, was thinking we're in a very volatile political moment. And I think time will kind of sift through all of that other stuff. And I think this movie is a great reminder that politics in the moment is always fraught. But history will always point to, you know, the phrase, the right side of history is, all, you know, is there for a reason, that history will always point to the people that were fighting the good fight. So that's as much as I can say without turning this into a political podcast, but I think this is a political movie, so it's hard not to talk about that.
It certainly has been a good day to sit down and think about this film again and revisit it with you fine gentlemen. So thank you so much to everybody that has been listening. Of course, you can continue to find us on nprillinois.org. You can find us under the Community Voices tab on that page. You also can find the Front Row Network on any social media platform you're looking for, really, other than TikTok. We have not ticked the talks yet. But you can find us by looking at the Front Row Network.
We need someone in their 20s to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're all way too old.
Absolutely, we do. But thank you so much for listening along. Continue to listen to all of our shows. I, of course, am one of the co-hosts of Beyond the Mouse. So if you like all things Disney, check us out and make sure to add that feed. You can subscribe to that feed in particular. And we talk all things parks over there. We talk movies. We've done a lot of interviews. We've had some really cool interviews recently all about the Disney company. Steve, you want to promote your View from the Back Row?
Yes, we are one episode into View from the Back Row, which, as you mentioned, is about disability representation in film. We've got some great episodes coming up. We're going to be talking about later this month about Unbreakable, because we're coming up on a significant anniversary of its release, and we'll look at it from the perspective of how disabilities are addressed in that series of films.
Such a cool concept for a podcast. And I would almost say you've had one and a half episodes, because your Diane Franklin interview kind of went into that. So
true.
Wonderful conversation that you got to have with her as well. Luke, can you speak to us about how they find Guilty Pleasures?
Yes, you can. You can definitely find it on the main feed, but we also have a separate feed, Guilty Pleasures, that you can find on all the different Spotify, Apple, Amazon, all that, all those different apps, because if you subscribe to that, you'll get some bonus content. You'll get maybe some less safe for work content, but so that we don't, you know, we don't besmirch the good name of the Front Row or NPR, and we can be in our own little catty corner. Guilty Pleasures is up and running. I just did, we did our Monster Cast episodes on Mr. Boogity and Vampire in Brooklyn that were a lot of fun. I'm gearing up to talk Godfather Part 3 with Eric and Brandon from Classics to wrap up our Godfather coverage. Although I guess not wrap it up, because next month we get the Francis Ford Coppola recut of Godfather 3, the Coda, as he's calling it. But yeah, exactly. He went all Snyder cut on us for Godfather 3. So now I get to watch Godfather 3 twice in 1 month. So yay. Catch that. And I know we've got Christmas seasons rolling up, which is just Guilty Pleasure's best time of the year. So we're going to be hitting a lot of Christmas movies. Also, I'm very excited to talk about a special episode that we're going to do on Facebook for any fans of Survivor that you're missing the current season of Survivor. We're going to be doing a Survivor simulation on live on Facebook, hopefully, if I can figure out the technical, but we will put the podcast up. We're going to do a simulated Survivor season, and we're calling it Survivor Movie Heroes versus Villains. 10 of the greatest movie heroes of all time, 10 of the greatest villains of all time, playing a season of Survivor, and we'll see how it washes out. But for all that stuff, you can also follow me on Twitter at @TheFakeLouHair.
Absolutely. I can't wait for that Survivor episode. Also, I've got to say, put it on Front Street. Christmas Chronicles, one of my favorite Christmas movies now. I go back to it every year. Thank you, Netflix. And we're getting a sequel this year. So
we are.
Maybe that might be something that you cover in the near future.
It is the crew who helped me do the first one has already been, we've been DMing like crazy with trailers and clips. And we're all there. Yes, it's happening no matter what.
Absolutely. Thank you all so much for listening. Remember that you can also subscribe to us on Patreon, so you can find us there, patreon.com/thefrontrownetwork. You can get some bonus content out of that and actually have some monthly discussions with our hosts. We have so many hosts and so many different shows. You also can, depending on the pay level, you can become a guest on the show or at least tell us what kind of content you would like and request specific movies, specific topics for all the shows. So you can also check us out there. Thank you so much. This has just been an incredible hour and 40 minutes discussing quite the film. I appreciate it. We almost met the runtime of the film, which means we ought to wrap this thing up. So for the Front Row Network, I am Craig.
I'm Lou.
And I'm Steve.
And we will see you in the Front Row.